Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Wednesday, April 24th. Your readers tonight are Mark Barat and
Mary Grace Payden.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We will begin by reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by the Money, Sports, and Life sections. At 8:30 tonight, our featured program will be grocery ads. But to get us started, here's Mary Grace with the TV listings.
Thank you, Mark. This evening on ABC at 8 p.m., The Conners, 8:30, Not Dead Yet, 9:30, The $100,000 Pyramid, and from 10 to 11, The $100,000 Pyramid. On CBS at 8, Survivor, which extends until 9:30, at which time The Amazing Race begins. On Fox at 8, The Masked Singer. At 9, Animal Control. At 9:30, A Family Guy. And then at 10, WRAL's 10 p.m. News on Fox 50. NBC at 8, Chicago Med. 9 o'clock, Chicago Fire. And 10, Chicago PD. On ION, we have three episodes of Blue Bloods. One beginning at 8, another at 9, and at 10. PBS this evening at 8, Changing Planet, Coral Special. 9 o'clock, A Brief History of the Future, Human. And Nova at 10, Making North America, Life. On MNT, three episodes of Dateline at 8, 9, and 10. On CW at 8, Walker. 9 o'clock, Sight Unseen, 10, National, and another National at 10:30. On A&E this evening, six episodes of Court Cam, 8, 8:30, 9, 9:30, 10, and 10:30. AMC at 8, the film The Day After Tomorrow, which extends until 10:30, at which point the film The Fifth Element begins. On BET, three episodes of Black, one at 8, 9, and 10. On Disney this evening at 8, Haley's On It, and another episode of that at 8:30. 9 o'clock, Marvel's Moon Girl. And then 9:30, 10, and 10:30, three episodes of Ladybug. On the Discover Channel at 8, Expedition, Legend of the Snake King. At 9, Expedition Unknown, Ghost Ship of the Great Lakes. And at 10, Ghost Adventures, House Calls. On Nickelodeon at 8, SpongeBob SquarePants, and then four episodes of Friends at 9, 9:30, 10, and 10:30. On TNT at 8, a continuation of the NBA basketball game at the Boston Celtics Eastern Conference first round. And another of those begins at 9:30, and this one will be held at Oklahoma City Thunder. And then last of all, on USA at 8, Law and Order SVU, 9 o'clock, Law and Order SVU, and 10 o'clock, Chucky.
Moving to the front page, our first article is headlined, Columbia, a Natural Nexus of Activism, University Has History of Upheaval on Campus. Americans disagree vehemently about the Israel-Hamas war. The conflict has divided friends and strained families, become a third rail in the workplace, and poses a serious political problem for President Joe Biden. Over the past week, all that roiling discord seems to have focused with laser-like precision on one place, Columbia University in New York City. The Ivy League school's lush campus on the Upper West Side of Manhattan is known for many things. It's where the popular TV show Gossip Girl was often filmed. It's where Barack Obama finished his bachelor's degree, and Hillary Clinton is now a professor. It even has a Donald Trump connection. Trump once called the university's former president a moron for refusing to buy land from him for a new campus. And when law enforcement arrested more than 100 protesters on campus last week, a day after the university's president testified in Washington about her handling of a spike in anti-Semitism, it recalled an era of foment in the late 60s that put the school on the national map. The tumult on the New York City campus is more than just a political spectacle, though. It has become a microcosm of the intractable challenges facing higher education in the 21st century, from managing political interference to balancing freedom of speech with a need to keep students and the staff safe. It's not a shock that Columbia has become a focal point for campus strife. The school is based in the largest city in America, with the second biggest Jewish population in the world after Tel Aviv. About a fifth of the country's Muslim population is in New York City, too. The campus is easily accessible and open, a vestige of the political upheaval caused by students during the Vietnam War. Columbia has taken flak for years from progressives who view its growth into West Harlem as an example of gentrification, and conservatives who see it as a bastion of liberalism. All those factors have influenced the level of outrage on and around campus in recent weeks. As similar protests crop up at other universities, the demonstrations at Columbia, and the choices its leaders are making are having a butterfly effect on schools nationwide. I'm deeply saddened by what is happening on our campus, Manoush Shafiq, the university's president, wrote in a message to students and staff Monday morning. Our bonds as a community have been severely tested in ways that will take a great deal of time and effort to reaffirm. Last Wednesday, Shafiq traveled to Washington to address Republicans who had called her to a hearing about anti-Semitism on Columbia's campus. Flanked by other administrators, she fended off a salvo of tough questions from Republicans and Democrats alike, many of whom expressed dismay about reports that Jewish students have felt unsafe since Hamas' deadly attack on Israel October 7th. Grilling from those same lawmakers tripped up the presidents of Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania at a similar proceeding in December, ultimately pushing them out of their posts. Shafiq managed to dodge the mistakes of her peers, but drew the ire of many Columbia faculty with her responses to questions from some politicians about individual professors whom lawmakers singled out. People feel extraordinarily betrayed by her lack of following university protocol, said Patricia Daly, an associate English professor and vice president of Columbia's chapter of the American Association of University Professors. She's caved already to the ways in which this discourse is framed. Things only got more hectic from there. While the cameras were trained on Shafiq in Washington, students set up camps on lawns at the center of campus, demanding the university sever all its ties to Israel. The next morning, Shafiq called in the New York City Police Department to clear out the demonstrators. Officers arrested more than 100 people. Law enforcement officials later said no injuries or violence were associated with that specific protest, according to the campus newspaper, the Columbia Daily Spectator. Tempers flared on the edges of the partially closed campus as rallies continued over the weekend. By Monday, the White House had jumped into the fray, condemning reports of anti-Semitic rhetoric around the campus. A university rabbi warned Jewish students to stay home for their safety, though the Campus Hillel Center chapter disagreed with that recommendation. All classes were held online Monday. By then, students at a growing number of universities across the country, including Harvard, Yale, and the University of California, Berkeley, were taking their cues from Columbia, launching similar protests in solidarity. Colleges and universities have long been hotbeds for activism, playing an important role in shaping public sentiment on controversial issues. At Columbia, campus activism has been a particularly contentious history. In 1968, massive student demonstrations threw the campus into violence and chaos. Anger over the university's ties to the Vietnam War and its plans to build what would effectively have been a segregated school gym on public land led to hundreds of arrests. In the end, administrators ended the school's relationship with a war-connected think tank. Construction on the gym was halted. The 1968 protests altered administrators' attitudes about Columbia's relationship with the city, creating an impulse that persists today to make the campus feel open to the broader community. It took Columbia decades to recover its reputation and its endowment. The fallout from that upheaval sent the university into a financial tailspin, souring relationships with rich donors. Some New Yorkers still haven't forgotten the episode. Outside the school gates Monday, a 70-year-old Columbia alum, who identified herself by her first name, Daphne, held a sign that read, "50 years ago I was here to end the Vietnam War. Today I am here to say Free Palestine." She declined to give her full name because she said she feared being doxxed. Like the now former presidents of Harvard and Penn, Shafiq is new to her job. She took over the presidency last year. Her lack of familiarity with the campus's history and dynamics likely hasn't been the best thing for all the controversy, said Robert McCauley, a emeritus history professor at Barnard College and author of Stand Columbia, A History of Columbia University. And like her ousted Ivy League peers, she faces calls to resign. Republicans in the New York congressional delegation urged Shafiq over the weekend to step down. The fact that she called in police somewhat placated Representative Virginia Fox, a congresswoman from North Carolina and the powerful Republican chair of the House Education Committee. She has not called for the president's ouster. McCauley, who has studied every leader of the university, said he believes Shafiq's presidency will survive. She's got some time.
In landmark high court case, Trump's test case is Nixon, Washington. At landmark arguments Thursday in Donald Trump's long-shot Supreme Court bid for presidential immunity, his test case is Richard Nixon. After Nixon avoided criminal charges from Watergate through a presidential pardon, he set the standard for whether presidents can face lawsuits. An Air Force weapons analyst had sued Nixon, claiming he'd been fired in retaliation for telling Congress about massive cost overruns in the Defense Department. A closely divided Supreme Court said in 1982 Nixon couldn't be held liable for official actions because civil suits would be too distracting for a president and make him unnecessarily cautious when carrying out his responsibilities. Now the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments Thursday on whether that same logic should apply to Trump's attempt to throw out the federal criminal charges he had attempted to steal the 2020 election. Many experts think the justices are likely to reject Trump's claim of absolute immunity. But even if they do, how long it takes them to issue an opinion and whether a majority finds that presidents have some immunity will determine if Trump can be tried before the November election. The first and most important pivotal question is whether the court will rule in a way that allows the case to then continue immediately, said Harry Lipman, a former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general. Trump trial already delayed. The Supreme Court's decision to hear the appeal of the presumptive GOP nominee has already diminished the chances that a trial that was supposed to start in March can be completed before the election. The delay has critics charging that the court may have already granted Trump immunity if there's no trial and Trump wins the election, putting him in a position to get rid of the Justice Department's case against him. I think that there have been some absolutely indefensible choices on the part of the United States Supreme Court that have effectively immunized Donald Trump. New York University law professor Melissa Murray said at a recent event sponsored by the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. But Stanley Brand, a former House General Counsel who has represented Trump aides in legal fights, said there's no expectation in criminal law that cases involving candidates need to fit within an election schedule. The notion that the criminal justice system is designed to give the electorate a reason to vote or not to vote is a complete abomination and distortion of what the criminal justice system is about, Brand said. The criminal justice system is never about what the public thinks. It's about the defendant's rights and whether the government has met its burden. New territory for Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is deciding a novel question because Trump is the first president, former or current, to be criminally charged. In the case before the High Court, Trump is accused of trying to overturn the 2020 election by spreading lies about election fraud and attempting to persuade state officials, his vice president, and Congress to prevent the certification of the legitimate results. The case is separate from criminal charges he faces in state courts in New York and Georgia and in federal court in Florida. Trump hopes the 1982 Supreme Court decision, Nixon versus Fitzgerald, will save him. In that ruling, the court said presidents are immune both while in office and after from civil damages for official acts, including those on the outer perimeter of a president's official responsibilities. President Trump has become Citizen Trump. Trump wants that same protection extended to criminal cases. Otherwise, his lawyers argue, the threat of future prosecution and imprisonment would become a political cudgel to influence the most sensitive and controversial presidential decisions, taking away the strength, authority, and decisiveness of the presidency. A denial of criminal immunity would incapacitate every future president with de facto blackmail and extortion while in office, and condemn him to years of post-office trauma at the hands of political opponents, his lawyers told the court in their main brief previewing their oral argument. The federal district judge overseeing Trump's trial and the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals didn't buy it. For the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump, with all of the defenses of any other criminal defendant, the unanimous three-judge panel of the appeals court wrote in a resounding rejection of Trump's claim. Even if Trump's actions were done in his official capacity, rather than in his personal one as a candidate, the public's interest in the enforcement of criminal laws is significant, the court said. And that's particularly true in a case involving a presidential election, they wrote. Special Prosecutor Jack Smith argues that the fact that President Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon shows that presidents have never expected to be immune from a criminal prosecution. A hard case to game out. Alex Reinert, a criminal law expert at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York City, said the Supreme Court likely agreed to hear Trump's appeal because of how important the issue of presidential immunity is. Reinert, who clerked for former Justice Stephen Beyer, said the justices will try to probe what level of immunity would balance the rule of law against the need for presidential protection, against baseless and harassing prosecutions. I think it's a hard case to game out, he said, but I do think it comes down to the outer boundaries of the rules that the court thinks is going to be manageable and supportable. It's got to be a principled line that's judicially manageable, that the court thinks won't have too many negative downstream consequences. But I do think there's a lot of leeway there for the court to figure out what the best rule is. Others hope the court will issue a narrow ruling specific to Trump's case and not take the time to explore other scenarios. Donald Trump has articulated an outrageous, unprecedented, and ahistorical assertion of absolute immunity, said former Obama White House ethics czar Norm Eisen. The Supreme Court need not stray into other questions just because Trump has made it easy for them. They should decide this case. Tough to get trial before election. If the Supreme Court rules that presidents enjoy criminal immunity only in specific circumstances, Trump wants the protection to spread as broadly as possible and wants the court to direct that any fact-based test be applied through additional proceedings before his trial can start. Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith has told the court any qualifications it puts on immunity should not delay the trial. If the justices agree with Smith, a trial could start before the election, though may not finish, Reinert estimates. I think it would take a lot to get to a trial before November, he said, but I do think it's possible. Not a fast process. John Yoo, a former Justice Department official under George W. Bush, expects Trump's broad immunity argument to fail, but thinks Trump can still fight some of the charges. I think the court will deny immunity, but then let him proceed to make his substantive attacks on the indictment, Yoo said during a Federalist Society preview of the case. Brand said even run-of-the-mill, white-collar cases he's been involved in can take years to go to trial. The expectation has been created that this is a fast process, he said. Generally, it's not.
Most nursing homes in the United States will need to add staffing under a federal rule announced Monday that for the first time sets minimum staffing ratios nationwide for homes that care for elderly and disabled people. The rule announced Monday by Vice President Kamala Harris mandates that nursing homes meet minimum staffing requirements for registered nurses and nurse aides. The rule is intended to limit cases of resident neglect or delays in care, a lingering issue that was exposed when more than 200,000 nursing home residents and staff died from COVID-19 in the first 2 years of the pandemic. Experts call the rule a significant step toward bolstering nursing home quality and safety. This is the most important nursing home reform in decades, said David Grabowski, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. We need more staff in nursing homes. This is a big development in terms of setting a floor such that nursing homes can't grossly understaff facilities. Mark Parkinson, president and CEO of the nursing home industry group American Healthcare Association, blasted the rule as unconscionable given the nation's nursing shortage. Issuing a final rule that demands hundreds of thousands of additional caregivers when there's a nationwide shortfall of nurses just creates an impossible task for providers, Parkinson said in a statement. This unfunded mandate doesn't magically solve the nursing crisis. The White House said in a fact sheet the new rule requires all nursing homes receiving federal funding through Medicare and Medicaid to provide staffing that is the equivalent of nearly 3.5 hours of daily care for each resident. The rule also requires that nursing homes have registered nurses on duty 24 hours, 7 days a week, to provide skilled nursing, which will further improve nursing home safety. On average, a nursing home with 100 residents would have 2 to 3 registered nurses and at least 10 nurse assistants on duty for each shift around the clock. Officials said this level of staffing is necessary to provide safe care with good outcomes for vulnerable residents. Xavier Becerra, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, told USA Today on Monday these staffing requirements represent the minimum level of care for more than 1.2 million Americans in federally certified nursing homes. If you're going to represent yourself to be a nursing home, you should have a nurse available for care for my loved one that I'm about to put in your facility, Becerra said. We insist that the care that you're going to provide must be quality. It's a level of care any family member would expect, he said. The Biden administration said the rule will be implemented in phases to give nursing homes, especially those in rural communities, time to hire additional workers. Nursing homes must complete an assessment gauging the day-to-day needs of residents within 90 days of the rule being finalized. The minimum staffing levels will be phased in over 2 to 3 years. Nursing homes in communities facing a workforce shortage will get limited temporary exemptions to meet the registered nurse requirement and overall staffing ratios, the White House said. Federal and academic researchers have long established staffing levels as the best predictor of quality nursing home care. However, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which regulates nursing homes that take Medicare and Medicaid funding, has never required a specific number of nurses and aides. The agency has only made recommendations, which few facilities followed. In a related rule also announced Monday, the Biden administration seeks to bolster home care for seniors and disabled residents on Medicaid, the federal health program for low-income populations. The rule requires companies that provide home care services spend a minimum of 80% of Medicaid payments on workers' wages. The Biden administration said higher wages for home health care workers would reduce turnover and lead to higher quality home care for the elderly and disabled. Home health care workers can sometimes find a better paying job going to flip burgers than to offer your loved one the care that he or she needs. Becerra said, we need to do more. The home care rule, which is similar to the rule on nursing home staffing ratios, would allow states to account for unique experiences that small home care providers and providers in rural areas face in meeting such requirements, the White House said. A USA Today investigation found that although nursing homes have submitted daily staffing data to federal officials for years, they have rarely been punished for violating the existing guidelines and rules. Such penalties have been unusual, even at facilities where inspectors noted low staffing in the course of investigating unavoidable deaths and people who suffered broken bones, spent days without help getting out of bed, or hours sitting in feces, among other violations. Fines for such violations have even been rarer.
World leaders debate treaty on plastics. On the eve of an international meeting to debate a global treaty on plastic pollution, Earth Day 2024 on Monday highlighted the planet's growing problem with plastics in events ranging from beach cleanups and seminars to an environmental demonstration in Seoul, South Korea. Since the first Earth Day in 1970, plastic has become more ubiquitous in our environment. It's now considered a crisis of global proportion, according to the United Nations Intergovernmental Committee to develop an international legally binding instrument on plastic pollution, including in the marine environment. This is right there with the climate change as a primordial threat to the planet, pediatrician Leonardo Trezzande, a researcher and professor at New York University, told journalists at the Society of Environmental Journalists meeting in Philadelphia earlier in April. Billions of bits of plastic infiltrate waterways and oceans, are consumed in beverages and food, and are found in the internal organs of people and wildlife. A 2023 paper published by the National Library of Medicine and others shows microplastics can wreak havoc on hormones and contribute to a range of health problems. In the lead-up to Earth Day 2024, EarthDay.org organizers promoted the theme Planet versus Plastics, calling for a massive reduction in plastic production and the waste stream, and urging people to sign a petition backing the treaty. Additional Earth Day events are planned throughout the country. On Tuesday, in Ottawa, Canada, the UN committee begins a week-long session to try to agree to a draft agreement on plastics in the environment. It's the fourth meeting since 2022 when the UN agreed to develop a treaty to try to curb the flow of plastics into the environment. Here's a breakdown of some of the key terms and major issues expected to be discussed. What is microplastic? Plastic has been found in every corner of the world and is turned up in drinking water, beer, salt, and honey, according to Oceana, an ocean conservation group. While some may think of plastic pollution as plastic shopping bags or soda bottles, it's the tiniest particles, microplastics and nanoplastics, raising the biggest concerns. Microplastics, for example, are tiny particles of polymers less than 5 millimeters long, no bigger than a grain of rice. They come from plastic bottles, synthetic clothing fibers, car tires, and other products as plastics break down slowly. Anika Derlenga, a program head at the National Institutes of Health, said, "We know very little about what these microplastics or even smaller pieces of plastics, known as nanoplastics, can do to human health in the short or long term, or even what they can do to the health of the sea turtles and other animals that live in the ocean. Nanoplastics are even smaller, only 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, according to the National Nanotechnology Initiative. By comparison, a strand of human DNA is 2.5 nanometers in diameter, and a human hair is approximately 80,000 to 100,000 nanometers wide, the initiative says. How has the use of plastics increased around the world? The annual production of plastic, including polymer resins and fibers, increased from 2 million tons in 1950 to 459.75 million tons in 2019, according to Our World in Data, based on a 2023 paper about plastic production published in the journal Science Advances. Estimates suggest that less than 10% of plastic waste in the U.S. is recycled, while a majority heads to landfills. How can plastics be harmful? Plastic and the particles it produces can be found from the Arctic tundra to the deepest oceans, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the UN. It includes everything from large items such as bottles, jugs, and plastic bags floating in the ocean and washing up on beaches, to the particles that a recent study found may be linked to an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, and death. One study found bottled water can contain 10 to 100 times more plastic bits than previously thought. While other studies have found microplastics in clouds, rain, and in the placentas of pregnant people. For some, the bigger concerns beyond the tide of plastic bits are the chemicals and contaminants they carry that have been linked to endocrine disruption and other abnormalities in the human body and the harmful fossil fuel emissions from the production of plastic. Studies show that microplastics accumulate chemicals and pathogens on their surfaces. Microplastics are likely the drug delivery system, Trasande said. It's the chemicals riding them that are causing the damage. What will the plastic treaty discussions include? The UN committee is scheduled to discuss polymers, waste management, trade, pollution, financing, and technology as it tries to reach an agreement among the world's governments in an effort similar to the talks in Paris in 2015 that produced the Global Treaty on Climate Change. Reuters has reported that many plastic and petrochemical producing countries, including China, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, do not support language in favor of production limits. Last week, in advance of the treaty talks, the American Chemistry Council, a trade industry for chemical manufacturers in the U.S., released a study by Oxford Economics, which concluded a production cap on virgin plastics would carry major economic costs. The study, commissioned by the International Council of Chemical Associations, concluded that the implementation of a proposed plastics production cap would have unintended global implications going beyond the plastics industry. In a web page on plastics and the treaty, the State Department said the U.S. supports the development of an ambitious global agreement on plastic pollution that has universal obligations throughout the lifetime of plastics. A major focus of the proposed international treaty is plastic in the marine environment. Millions of tons of microplastics, ranging from the size of a width of a pencil to smaller than a sesame seed, find their way into the oceans, according to the National Institutes. The particles move through the food chain to people, and they also attract pollutants and carry them into new environments. An estimated 33 billion pounds of plastic wash into the ocean every year, about 2 garbage trucks worth of plastic every minute, according to Oceana. The group has cited a nationwide poll conducted by Ipsos in December 2022 that showed 83% of American voters are concerned about single-use plastic products, and 73% support a pause in building new plastic production facilities. April Burt, a conservation scientist with the University of Oxford, said her work in the Seychelles, an archipelago in the Indian Ocean of Africa, highlights the vast accumulation of marine plastic pollution bombarding the islands from both at sea and international sources. But it's not too late to stem the flow, she said. The Global Plastics Treaty gives us the opportunity to turn the tide on plastic pollution, from policy on the manufacture of plastics to retailer responsibilities and dealing with legacy plastics.
You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned subchannel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website, ncreadingservice.org. You can listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assisted technology device, such as Alexa or Google Home, just say Tune in NC Reading Service to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following their initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, click on the Listen tab, and then click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Tactile tours are available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision, these docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are by request only and must be scheduled at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule one, please call the Museum of Art at 919-664-6854 or email Accessibility Coordinator Molly Hull at mhull@ncartmuseum.org. Accessible Pharmacy, a provider of home-delivered prescription medicines with talking bottles, is hosting the first annual Blindness and Mental Health Summit. This virtual and free summit is the largest online gathering of organizations and consumers sharing information, resources, and services focusing on mental health in the blindness, low vision, and disability communities. The Blindness and Mental Health Summit will be held online Friday, June 14th from noon until 4 p.m. For more information or to register for this free online event, visit the Accessible Pharmacy website at accessiblepharmacy.com. That's A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-L-E. pharmacy.com. You'll find the Blindness and Mental Health Summit under the Events tab. And lastly, get active and get outdoors. The North Carolina Assistive Technology Program has been hosting pop-up fairs at various locations throughout the state. Learn about local resources and get hands-on experience with accessible equipment, regardless of your ability, at an adaptive recreation and active living resource fair. Fairs are free and open to the public. We encourage everyone interested in staying active, accessible recreation and leisure activities to attend. The next pop-up fair will be held next Friday, May 3rd, from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. at the Charlotte AT Center in Charlotte. The event is free, but registration is required. To register or to learn more about the NCATP Center near you, please visit their website at www.ncdhhs.gov/NCATP.
And now our first opinion piece, written by James E. Causey, who is an Idea Labs reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where this column originally appeared. And it's entitled, "He Was Locked Up, and Now He Keeps People Out of Prison." 10 years. That's how long in prison Ruben Gayana received for his role in a drug ring that transported cocaine and marijuana from Texas to Milwaukee in March 2010. Gayana grew up in El Paso with a single mom and five siblings. His father was mentally and physically abusive to his mother. One time, his father broke into his bedroom window with a gun and threatened to kill the family. We called 911 on him. After that, my mom knew she had to leave him, Gayana said. His mother, Maria Reyes, relocated the family to Milwaukee's South Side in June 1996, making the trek on a Greyhound bus. Gayana was 15. During his senior year at Pulaski High School, 1999, Gayana received life-changing news. He would be a father. Faced with limited job options, Guyana decided to join the U.S. Navy for the direction he needed. At first, everything seemed to be going well. The Navy provided a meaningful alternative to what he had seen growing up. He quickly developed a passion for it. But 45 days before he was set to re-enlist, he was told he couldn't because of a back injury. The Navy determined Guyana was unfit for sea. He received an honorable discharge and was back on Milwaukee's south side. That's when he made the dumbest decision of his life. On March 17, 2010, Guyana was one of 17 defendants charged in a drug conspiracy and money laundering case. Several of his siblings also were involved. Despite receiving monthly visits from his family and communicating with them through letters and phone calls, the absence of their physical presence was deeply felt. Nonetheless, his mother remained a stalwart source of support. Twice a month, Ray drove Guyana's wife and kids nearly 6 hours to visit him in prison. Their unwavering support was crucial for him as it helped him get through tough times. However, not all prisoners are fortunate enough to have someone to support them, leading many to reoffend once they are released. Guyana made a promise to his mother that he would never let her down again. Nearly 13 years later, he has dedicated himself to helping people who were once in prison. His nonprofit organization, My Way Out, has been successful in keeping more than 600 people out of prison by providing essential services such as housing, employment, and transportation. The program has a 90% success rate. The effort began as thousands of prisoners were being released early from state and federal prisons to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Many were released with just the clothing they came with and without a solid reintegration plan to avoid going back to prison. My Way Out offers support for things that might not be apparent to most of us. For instance, when a client needed a winter coat, Guyana's team purchased a new one for the man. When another landed a job but needed reliable transportation, the team bought the man a 10-speed bike. Guyana, 42, said since his team doesn't have office space, they can meet the client where they are. If someone calls me right now, I ask them where they are and go to them to make it easier. We do a lot of meetings in coffee shops and the library, he said. It's hard enough for them. We don't want to make it more difficult. If they cannot provide needed services, they collaborate with other reentry programs to ensure clients receive what they need. The program operates on donations from organizations such as the United Way, Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Bader Philanthropies, Milwaukee Bucks Foundation, Roots and Wings, and others. More than 70% of the clients served are African American or Hispanic. Anthony Dodd, assistant superintendent at the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center, called My Way Out a valuable safety net. Addressing stable housing and employment are critical to the success of men and women, and Guyana has helped hundreds in the area. Dodd said that after a person has served their time, there needs to be a higher level of forgiveness and second chances. Approximately 95% of state prisoners will be released at some point, with 80% of them placed under parole supervision. Many people don't consider public safety in terms of ensuring that formerly incarcerated individuals have access to stable housing, good jobs, and transportation. However, Dodd said, these factors are crucial in reducing recidivism rates. My Way Out stands out from other reentry organizations because all its employees have been incarcerated. Frank Harris Sr., 63, felt out of touch with technology after serving 26 years in prison for homicide. My Way Out employees helped him overcome his fears. When Harris was incarcerated, his son was only 14. One thing he always wanted to do was take him to a Brewers baseball game. My Way Out gave him that opportunity once he was released by providing him with two tickets to see the Brewers play at American Family Field. Frank Harris Jr., 44, said it was an experience he would never forget. "I'd been to a baseball game before. I've just never seen one with my dad. It was a perfect day. I don't even remember who won the game. I know that I enjoyed that time with my dad," Harris Jr. said. At an event held at Bader Philanthropies in January, Harris Sr. and other individuals shared their positive experiences with the organization. One man spoke about how the organization provided him and his son with safe housing, while another thanked God for always being available to provide assistance, regardless of the time of day. Another shared how the staff helped him find employment, which ultimately led to him landing a better job as a barber. During his speech, Gaana shared a quote he had written down 5 years into his sentence that changed his life. He now lives by these words. "I can't" does not exist, as it is merely an excuse we tell ourselves to avoid reaching our full potential. Gaana's story mirrors that of many clients he serves today. But he wants them to know that they have the power to create a new reflection.
Our second opinion piece is written by James Allen Fox, who is the Lippman Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University. And his piece is titled, "Shock of Columbine Misled Us to Believe Schools Aren't Safe." When it comes to mass killing, April 20th is a day of infamy. On that date, 25 years ago, two teenagers became arguably the most notorious school shooters in U.S. history by gunning down a dozen classmates and one teacher at Columbine High in Littleton, Colorado. The 1999 Columbine Massacre was neither the first nor the deadliest school shooting in our nation's past, but by all measures it's the most significant in its impact on school policies, public attitudes, and popular culture. For the first time, the horrific drama was broadcast live. Recordings of the two assailants planning and practicing for the assault were released publicly. Regrettably, a Columbine video game, T-shirts, and other cultural artifacts gave the two shooters the celebrity status they sought. Dylan Klybold and Eric Harris fully expected to achieve fame and notoriety, as one of the assailants predicted in the so-called Columbine basement tapes, quote, "I know we're going to have followers because we're so godlike," unquote. And their influence has persisted ever since, with more than 100 copycats committing or attempting to commit similar attacks at schools across America. The Columbine effect is much wider than the occasional acts of copycats. It includes ways in which schools have been transformed in terms of security and the widespread perception of students and their parents that schools are unsafe. In the aftermath of Columbine, parents began to purchase bullet-resistant backpacks for their children, and schools began to stage lockdown drills that have questionable value but unnerve many impressionable children with attempts at realism. Columbine might have been the catalyst for widespread panic, but various data reports have served to reinforce and increase the sense of danger. For example, the Center for Homeland Defense and Security's K-12 school shooting database suggests that the number of incidents has grown exponentially, with nearly 1,000 cases since 2021. Importantly, the definition of a school shooting used in this database is, quote, quite broad, quote, "a gun is fired, brandished, or bullet hits school property, regardless of the number of victims, including zero, time, day, or reason," unquote. My analysis as a professor of criminology of the K through 12 school shooting data for the past 3 years indicates that nearly 90% of these shootings did not take place inside the school itself, but in parking lots, athletic fields, or school buses, where lockdown drills and metal detectors are not relevant. Of course, frightened parents think about the threat of a Columbine-type massacre when confronted with these statistics. However, the overwhelming majority of incidents have little to do with the safety of their children while in school. The fear of students and their parents are focused more on active shooters, whether they are students or outsiders, roaming the hallways armed with a powerful instrument of death. Based on my review of FBI documents, since Columbine there have been 50 of that specific type of attack, resulting in victim injuries or fatalities, for an average of 2 per year. Of course, that is out of nearly 130,000 schools in America. Although understandable, our response to school shootings, requiring students to participate in active shooter drills, arming teachers, installing security equipment, is out of proportion with the actual risk. These actions intensify fears rather than alleviate them by suggesting to students that a bullseye is on their backs. While there may be a handful of students who idolize the Columbine shooters and decide to follow their lead, history suggests that we might reduce fears as well as the risk by downplaying the threat of school shootings. From 1996 through 2001, there were 8 multiple fatality school shootings in the United States, prompting newsman Dan Rather in March 2001 to declare that school shootings were a national epidemic. But then there were none for the next 4 years. Once the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks took place, Americans shifted their attention and concerns away from school shootings and squarely on a different threat to their safety. I'm certainly not suggesting that we invite a tragedy to deflect attention from school shootings, only that we keep the risk in its proper perspective. Schools are indeed safe. Offered structure and supervision, children are safer in school than out.
And now moving to the money section. Foldable and dual screens boost computer view. We Americans love to supersize, and not just with fast food. Our automobiles are bigger, our homes are larger than almost anywhere else. Even our TVs are bigger. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of Americans discovered they could work bigger by attaching large monitors to their laptops and spread their work-from-home space across both screens. With the added real estate, folks found they were more productive because they could, for example, simultaneously view the email they were writing and the reports they were writing about. As a result, the historically moribund PC monitor market blossomed with double-digit growth in 2020 and 2021. It's great to be venturing out again, but untethering from the big screen and working with just a laptop in a coffee shop or on a plane can be a strain for our bigger is better psyche. The need for screen. PC makers feel your pain, and a few of them have come up with innovative new ways to gain back some digital elbow room on the road. Laptops like HP's Spectre Foldable 17, priced at $4,999.99, and the Lenovo X1 Fold, $2,299.08, have made a splash because their glass displays fold. Dual display systems, the new Asus ZenBook Duo at $1,499.99 and Lenovo YogaBook 9i at $1,999.99, which became available last summer, represent a more economical and expansive, if bulkier, option. Samsung, a pioneer in foldable smartphones, doesn't currently offer either a foldable or dual-screen laptop. But the company's newer PC features a novel and potentially more economical approach to this nascent segment. Its newer notebook PCs can put some Samsung tablets to work as second screens. I've been evaluating one of the dual-screen options, the Asus ZenBook Duo, as well as one of the foldables, the Lenovo X1 Fold. I've also been pairing Samsung's new flagship PC, the Galaxy Book 4 Ultra, with my circa 2021 Galaxy Tab S7 Plus tablet. They're all cool, but there are trade-offs that may or may not matter to you, depending on where you go and what you do when you leave the big display behind, and of course, on how much you're willing to spend. I was bug-eyed the first time I unfurled the Lenovo X1 Fold into an expansive 16-inch workspace, because it was so cool to have a screen that expanded. Then I fumbled a bit with the stand, which itself unfolds. The stand does take time to get familiar with, but I'm used to it now. I'm also used to wrapping the stand around the magnetized keyboard as a travel cover. I thought it would bother me to carry a two-piece laptop, that is, the folded display along with the keyboard-infused stand, but it didn't. It helps that the X1 Fold and its accompanying components, the keyboard and the case, together weigh just 2.86 pounds, the lightest rig here. Using the X1 Fold on your lap like your traditional clamshell device, placing the keyboard on the bottom half of the display and folding the top half upward works well. But it has the smallest laptop mode display of the bunch. It's even a little smaller than the Tab S7 Plus tablet's 12.4-inch display. That's not a problem if you're primarily using it to respond to email or read messages, but it can be cramped for multi-window tasks like taking notes in a Zoom meeting. One more thing. If your device is part workspace, part status symbol, and then the foldables are without a doubt the way to go. I've never had so many people ask me about a laptop before. Dual display. The soon-to-be-available Asus ZenBook Duo feels just like a traditional laptop. But when you spread out the dual 14-inch displays, it can be a bit overwhelming. There's a lot of workspace. The ZenBook Duo's keyboard is well-designed and it fits neatly across one screen, mimicking a typical laptop. The Duo's keyboard also sandwiches between the displays for storage. So it's a bit thick, but convenient. The big hinge between the displays is slightly jarring because you can't clearly lay windows across the middle like you can with the X1 Fold. But if you have a lot of dashboard-style windows, the Duo works well, with windows arranged side-by-side in geometric layout. Part-time second screen. Samsung tackles the travel display question with a different approach. Its Galaxy Book series laptops can give some Samsung tablets a side hustle as a second screen. I've been evaluating the second screen feature with the new Galaxy Book 4 Ultra and my 2.5-year-old Galaxy Tab S7 Plus. I've been frustrated in the past broadcasting from laptops to TV screens, so I had low expectations for the second screen app, but it works flawlessly, and it's compact. So I'm more willing to use it in tighter spaces than I am either the X1 Fold or the ZenBook Duo. The Ultra itself has surprisingly long battery life. It also supports a 16.3-inch display with almost as much real estate as the taller X1 Fold, so you arguably wouldn't be pining for an extender so often. But there are smaller, lower-cost laptops in the Galaxy Book 4 line that also can make use of Tab S-series displays, starting at $699.99. If you already travel with a tablet especially if it's a Samsung Tab S series tablet, then the second screen feature can be an effective, economical model.
With inflation picking up again and highly anticipated Federal Reserve interest rate cuts delayed, it may be a good time for Americans to tweak their investment and retirement portfolios, financial advisors say. While U.S. rate cuts are on hold, the European Central Bank suggested last week that its first rate cut could come in June. Though Europe's economy is anemic compared to the United States, those rate cuts could ignite more stock market growth that would benefit investors, advisors say. On the flip side, high U.S. rates could make U.S. fixed income a better investment. It's an excellent time to buy U.S. bonds with yields near the highest levels since October 2023, said James Sahagian, managing director of Ramapo Wealth Advisors at Stewart Partners. I also think it's worthwhile to diversify outside of the U.S. Europe's stock market is already on the rise. The Euro Stoxx 50, comprised of European blue chip stocks, is outperforming its U.S. counterpart, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. As of Tuesday, Euro Stoxx 50's one-year return is 15.77%, and its year-to-date gain is 8.75%, according to Bloomberg. That compares to the Dow Jones's 13.91% one-year return and 0.29% year-to-date gain, respectively. In Europe, their economy is starting to expand a little, and the ECB can aid that by reducing rates a little, said Derek Meiser, investment advisor and chief executive at Meiser Wealth Partners. Europe has room to lower rates because, unlike in the United States, there is little evidence of overheating to resurrect inflation, wrote Pierre-Olivier Gorinchis, economic counselor and director of research at the International Monetary Fund, in a blog post about the IMF's World Economic Outlook report released yesterday. The IMF also predicts Europe's economy will expand, registering 1.5% growth by 2025, but U.S. growth will gradually slow to 1.9%. How do lower rates help the economy? Central banks often lower interest rates to jumpstart lackluster economies as long as inflation is contained. Lower rates mean lower borrowing costs, encouraging people to spend and companies to invest. That in turn boosts corporate profits, production output, and the overall economy. The opposite is true if central banks raise rates. Higher rates increase borrowing costs, discouraging spending and investing to slow down a hot economy and inflation. They also encourage saving because people can earn a higher return on their money. After a string of record highs for U.S. stocks, some financial advisors see the market as overextended compared with European stocks. European companies are considerably more attractive based on valuations, Sahagian said. That merits more consideration. At the end of March, Europe's Stoxx 600 index traded at about 15 times its one-year forward price-to-earnings ratio, while its U.S. counterpart, the S&P 500 index, traded at 26 times, according to data. A lower price-to-earnings multiple indicates a more attractive investment opportunity. Bank of America's Global Fund Manager survey last month showed the largest allocation increase to European Union stocks since June 2020. Stick with U.S. Treasuries. If U.S. rates are going to stay higher for longer now, investors should keep their treasuries, which are yielding around 5%, advisors said. It will also add some stability to your portfolio because it's steady income, Meiser said. What should my 401k look like if I take these steps? Your allocation of stocks and bonds should always depend on your risk tolerance and how close you are to retirement, advisors say. The higher your risk tolerance or further away from retirement, the heavier the equity rating, they say. After you've decided your stock and bond allocation, you might consider taking 20% of whatever your equity position is and allocate it to a global investment fund, Miser said. If the fixed income portion of your portfolio, Sahagian likes the barbell, which means investing in short-term and long-term bonds. You gain from the high short-term interest rates while also locking in some decent long-term returns in case rates begin to fall. Miser likes 40% in 2 to 5 year notes, 30% in 5 to 10 years, and then the rest in 30-year bonds. The varying maturities give you the flexibility to reinvest money at various times and in various ways, including buying new treasuries. But with all retirement investors, consumers should consider what stage they are in life and what their goals and risk tolerance are before making moves, advisors say. And lastly, are Costco gold bars a good pick? Gold prices are near an all-time high, around $2,400 an ounce, reflecting a crisis of confidence, Sahagian said. People are looking at other assets that will hold up in the wake of uncertainties and upheaval. They're dissatisfied with government and monetary policy after the highest inflation in 4 decades and concurrent wars in Ukraine and Palestine, advisors said. Costco's a trusted source for buying things, including gold bars, and people are searching for alternative ways to invest, Sahagian said. So, is it a good idea and liquid? Yes, you can monetize it at some point. Miser's not so sure. Gold may have been a good idea 3.5 to 4 years ago when you could buy low and sell high, he said. That's the opposite of buying gold now. Today, you're buying it at the highest it's been in a long time, which typically means prices are reaching near their end. Costco gold bars may be better off as a novelty purchase, he said.
And now moving to sports. Justice to pay nearly $139 million. The Department of Justice announced on Tuesday that it will pay nearly $139 million to survivors of Larry Nassar's sexual abuse as part of a settlement stemming from the FBI's mishandling of the initial allegations. USA Today Sports and the Wall Street Journal first reported last week that a settlement had been agreed upon and would stretch into 9 figures. The Department of Justice specified in a news release that an amount of $138.7 million will be distributed to a group of 139 victims, working out to roughly $1 million per claimant on average. These allegations should have been taken seriously from the outset, Acting Associate Attorney General Benjamin Miser said in a statement. While these settlements won't undo the harm Nassar inflicted, our hope is that they will help to give the victims of his crimes some of the critical support they need to continue healing. Olympic champions Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, and Allie Raisman were among the more than 100 victims who filed claims with the Department of Justice in 2022, roughly a year after the release of a report by the department's inspector general. The report found that FBI officials in Indianapolis failed to respond to allegations of abuse they received involving Nassar with the utmost seriousness and urgency in 2015, a delay that allowed the abuse to continue. Nassar, the former U.S. women's national gymnastics team doctor and Michigan State employee, was found to have sexually assaulted more than 500 women and girls under the guise of providing medical treatment. He is now serving what will amount to a lifetime prison sentence on sexual assault and child pornography charges. The victims who filed administrative claims with the Justice Department are represented by a large, disparate group of attorneys. But four of those attorneys, who represent 77 of the 139 claimants, described the settlement in a statement Tuesday as monumental. We are proud to have achieved a monumental settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice that not only secures the recovery the survivors deserve, but also holds the DOG and FBI accountable for their failures. Thomas Boehm, Megan Bonanni, Michael Gruel, and Michael Pitt said in a joint statement. We hope this serves as a lesson for federal law enforcement, and they make the changes necessary to prevent anything like this from happening again. Tuesday's settlement brings the combined liability payouts in legal cases brought by victims of Nazar's abuse to more than $1 billion. Michigan State agreed to distribute $500 million to survivors, while USA Gymnastics reached a separate settlement with them worth $380 million.
The National Football League draft is tomorrow night, and before Caleb Williams emerged as the likely number one overall pick out of Southern California, he was Oklahoma's football's backup quarterback to Spencer Rattler. Most Sooner fans know the story of how Williams supplanted Rattler in the 2021 Oklahoma-Texas rivalry game, led the Sooners to a 21-point comeback win at the Cotton Bowl, and kept the job for the rest of the season before following former coach Lincoln Riley by transferring to the University of Southern California. Fast forward to 2024, where both Williams and Rattler, who spent his final two college seasons at South Carolina, are expected to be selected in the upcoming NFL draft. Prior to likely becoming the Chicago Bears' hopeful franchise quarterback, Williams looked back on his time as a backup at Oklahoma on a recent podcast appearance. "That one was really tough for me," Williams said recently on the Pivot podcast. He was then asked why it hurt when he wasn't named the starter before the season. "Because I was the best in the country," he replied. "I told many people before I went there, and there's a backstory to it all of why I was so fired up," Williams continued. "I told people before I went there that I was going to start and play and beat Rattler out. I thought I beat Rattler out in the spring, and he was projected number one and all that, so he started for six games, and so I prepared. Lincoln told me, keep going, and that's something I didn't understand. Those two words I did not understand when he told me, because I wasn't asking him, I wasn't going to beg him for playing time, but I came to him and asked him, how do I do it? How do I beat this dude out? Because he never let me get reps with the first team, never let me get reps with the older guys. I took advantage of my reps. I got after it, put my head down, and at a certain point, I felt like I beat him out. At the time, I was so angry, so frustrated, because I didn't feel like that was what I wanted to hear, because I felt like I was the best. I felt like I could have helped us win all the games, gotten more reps during the season, and I'm ready for those moments later in the season. I kept preparing the best I could so that when I had my moment, there was no way that he was ever getting it back.
And now moving to the life section, a movie review. Sasquatch Sunset leaves Bigfoot believers thinking big. If you've ever been intrigued by the myth that is Sasquatch, also known as Bigfoot, then Sasquatch Sunset is your kind of film. What kind of film? Think slapstick nature docudrama. The Office meets David Attenborough presents. Written and directed by David and Nathan Zeldner, the 90-minute movie imagines what it would be like to take cameras and follow a family of Bigfeet. Is that even the right term? Around the prehistoric forest and alleged Bigfoot stomping grounds of Northern California. There's anger, humor, sex, and death throughout this one-year journey, which stars, though you won't recognize them, Jesse Eisenberg of Zombieland and Riley Keough of Daisy Jones and the Six, as well as Nathan Zellner and Christoph Zajac-Denick. We asked the Zellner brothers to explain the meaning of this offbeat movie, their choice to set it in modern times, and why there's a lot of poop throwing. Do the filmmakers believe in Bigfoot? Among Bigfoot fans, there are believers and there are those who want to believe, says David Zellner. But regardless of where you stand, we humans need these stories. Because scientific advances essentially now have an explanation for almost everything, Zellner says, humans more than ever need to be able to connect to the unknown and the natural world, which Bigfoot represents. So much is mapped and explained now, he says. We need to have that sense of wonder, which hopefully you get watching this film. Folklore has been with us forever for a reason. What does the ending of Sasquatch Sunset mean? At the beginning of Sasquatch Sunset, it is unclear when the movie is taking place. All we see are ape-like creatures in a primordial forest. But about halfway through, the Sasquatch family stumbles across a redwood tree marked with a red letter X, a sign that logging is taking place nearby. They're baffled. Then they come across a camper's tent, a paved road, and finally, in the last scene, they're left standing in front of a giant building that says Bigfoot Museum. We wanted the beginning of the movie to have that Garden of Eden feel to it, but then gradually, as they make their journey, the family intersects with the human world, says Nathan Zellner. It seemed very logical for us to tell the story that way. Why do the stars of Sasquatch Sunset throw poop around? There are a few scenes in Sasquatch Sunset where the protagonists get upset and throw their poop. One instance is when a cougar is munching on the remains of one of their Bigfoot friends. Another is when they encounter an asphalt road and become enraged, which the Zellners say is their nod to the Looney Tunes cartoons of their youth. We wanted to normalize Bigfoot behavior and make them relatable in a way many animals are, says David Zellner. That includes things like marking their territory, often with excrement, as we know from cats and dogs, and yes, throwing their poop as apes do. It wasn't hard to get the actors to go along with the scatological humor, he adds. That yelling vocalization from Riley, that was all her screaming, says Nathan with a laugh. Adds David, Riley said that poop throwing scene was her favorite. She told me, you better not cut it out.
Mary Jane is impossible to shake. In Amy Herzog's miraculous and gutting new play, which opened yesterday, April 23rd, at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater, Rachel McAdams gives what is arguably the best performance of the Broadway season as an ordinary woman facing the unimaginable. The show begins on a seemingly monotonous day as Mary Jane, played by McAdams, chats idly in her kitchen with Ruthie, the superintendent of her cramped Queens apartment building. Cheerfully sipping a can of Coke, Mary Jane rattles on about subway buskers and a clogged sink until she's suddenly interrupted by beeping from the next room. She calmly gets up and walks inside a machine as a machine begins to whir, followed by the slurp of a suction tube and then silence. As people float in and out of her home, a devoted nurse, a Facebook friend, a college misfit, Mary Jane trickles out details about her toddler-aged son, Alex, who is incapacitated as a result of a brain bleed during a premature birth. Suffering from lung disease and cerebral palsy, Alex receives around-the-clock care from his unflagging single mom and a small community of caregivers. But Mary Jane bullishly refuses to let his ailments define him. Although the audience never sees Alex, she paints a vivid picture of her son, describing his palpable joy and occasional stubbornness, as well as his deep love of animals and wintertime. When he receives visitors with a glassy stare, Mary Jane waves it off with a self-deprecating joke. I think I wiped him out with 12 hours of mom time, she shrugs. Her constant reassurances that she's doing just fine, that Alex will turn a corner, are more for herself than they are for others. In less capable hands, Mary Jane could easily slip into Hallmark card sentimentality. But Herzog, author of 4,000 Miles, a 2013 Pulitzer Prize finalist, brings aching nuance and lived experience to the wrenching subject matter. Her daughter was born with a rare muscle disorder and died at age 11 last year. When Alex has a seizure midway through the play, the mounting dread and panicked 911 call are distressingly familiar. So too is the purgatory-like state of the hospital waiting room, which is brilliantly conveyed through Ben Stanton's stark lighting and Lael Jelinek's deceptively simple scenic design. We won't spoil the set reveal, but it's breathtaking. Herzog thoughtfully poses big questions about faith and uncertainty and leaves the audience with much to chew on after the spiritual, ambiguous final moments. The play is beautifully directed by Ann Kaufman, with an outstanding ensemble playing dual roles. But the production would crumble without a compelling Mary Jane to latch onto, and McAdams is nothing short of extraordinary. We've long known she's an accomplished dramatic actress with remarkably understated turns in Spotlight, Disobedience, and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. But in her radiant Broadway debut, the Oscar nominee unleashes every skill in her dizzying arsenal. Her Mary Jane is immediately endearing, navigating each new hurdle of the American healthcare system with disarming humor and grace. The character frequently is forgetful and apologetic, and McAdams grounds her with a sort of awkward charm that feels completely lived in. The A-lister finds the weary human being behind Mary Jane's chipper optimism, her voice cracking, eyes holding back tears as she recalls how Alex's father abandoned them. I hope he finds some peace, I really do, she stammers with wounded tenderness. With McAdams, the pain is always lingering just beneath a cracked half-smile, only ever boiling over during one devastating encounter with hospital staff. I don't know what to hope for anymore, she says afterward, grasping for any semblance of control in a world thrown off its axis. Broadway is teeming with marvelous performances this spring, from Sarah Pidgeon in the Fleetwood Mac indebted Stereophonic to Sarah Paulson in the pulpy and provocative Appropriate. But in an overcrowded season for new plays and musicals, it would be a damn shame to miss the sensational work that McAdams is doing in Mary Jane, which reminds us yet again why she's one of the finest actors working today. And we have a few birthdays celebrating today. Actress Shirley MacLaine turns 90. Singer Barbara Streisand is 82 today. Comedian Cedric the Entertainer is 60, and singer and talk show host Kelly Clarkson is 42. And Queen Elizabeth II and her love of dogs is being celebrated in her native England. The British monarch, who died in September 2022, was honored with a statue in Oakham, England on Sunday, which would have been her 98th birthday. The statue marks the first permanent memorial to Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II per the Rutland County Council. Oakham is based in Rutland County. The bronze statue shows Elizabeth striking a formidable pose while donning a gown, regal cape, and crown. She is surrounded by corgi statues, a tribute to Elizabeth's lifelong love of the Welsh dog breed. And you are listening to North Carolina Reading Service. Mark Baratta and
Mary Grace Payden
have been reading from the USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by the Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258 We thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Up next is our featured program, Grocery Ads.